heating is on, I am wearing a scarf, and rain is forecast for the next 10 days. I mention this to help anyone who doesn't live in LA feel a bit better. Bad weather is the least of this guest's problems. War correspondent Sue Turton flies by the seat of her pants every day when she's reporting from the theatre of war in Syria, Afghanistan, or Libya. In this episode of The Chat with Claire Fordham, award-winning journalist Sue Turton talks about war reporting, how President Trump is perceived around the world, sexism in journalism, her latest book, and the time she herself was front page news when a passerby pinched her bum live on air. We recorded this chat on Sue's houseboat in London, so please forgive the occasional squawking seagull. Put the kettle on, Tiago.
We simply must applaud them, the Chat podcast with Claire Fordham. Keep calm and chat on.
Sue Turton, thank you for chatting with me today.
My pleasure.
I'm very happy to be here with you on your houseboat, barge.
I like to call it a little ship.
It is a little ship. It's magnificent.
Thank you very much.
You like a barge. You lived in Chelsea.
I like a barge. I like water, of course. It's in my blood. Dad was at sea for 50 years as a merchant naval captain. And I think I was probably conceived on a boat.
Ooh.
And yeah, that went on from travelling around the world when I was six with him and spending quite a lot of time on ships to becoming quite a keen sailor. Used to compete quite a lot, and now I've, as well as this barge you're sitting on, I've a 57-foot yacht in the Mediterranean.
And you spend a lot of time in the sand reporting from the Middle East. I do want to get down to the nitty-gritty and talk about being embedded in war zones, Afghanistan, Syria, Iraq. You've been there, you've reported from there, and you have seen some terrible things. What was that experience like for
you?
Yeah,
I mean, embedded in with the military, well, particularly in Afghanistan, I spent some time embedded with the military. But, you know, I did 6 years straight as a war correspondent. First of all, the Afghanistan correspondent for Al Jazeera, and then moving on to covering the Arab uprisings and ISIS in Iraq. And a lot of the time, you're not with any military. And those are the most dangerous times, that you're kind of flying by the seat of your pants. And you'll yet generally be in one area or another that's been held by one group or another, and you'll have had the permission by whoever that is there to say they recognise you're a journalist and you're not a threat, and hopefully they won't do anything untoward. Sometimes you're not with any, and you're kind of switching sides in between the two, and that, again, brings a huge amount of risk.
Have you been in felt your life was in danger?
It depends what country you're in. If you're in somewhere like Libya during the revolution, or in Afghanistan, you often stay in relative comfort of a hotel, and you'll go to the theatre of war every day. And then it's up to you as to how close you want to get to where you know is incredibly dangerous. You can obviously get caught out thinking somewhere's safe and it isn't, but you make that decision, and it's almost like a day job. You go to the theatre of war, you do the job you need to do, and then you go home again and you have a shower and you have something to eat and you go to bed.
Do you sleep?
Yeah, and you sleep. But if you go...
nothing keeps you awake then?
No, you're usually so exhausted, you're probably pretty much sleep standing up, to be honest with you. Having said that, if something breaks overnight, the phone will ring and you're straight up having to do something live from where you are, trying to explain and make sense of what developments has happened. Or sometimes in Libya, we thought we were in a safe hotel and you'd be called in the middle of the night and told they're encroaching much closer than we thought. We need to make a run for it.
Who calls you to tell you that?
Well, your security are either keep an eye on it, or your producers will have fixers all over the place who are hopefully tipping us off as to where what's happening. In one particular time in Ajdabiya in Libya, we were in a hotel and we had to make a run for it. And the BBC team were with us as well. And they realised they'd forgotten something, and their fixer went back, and he was actually shot. He had a flak jacket on, and so he survived. He got out, but was obviously quite badly wounded. Well, injured, I suppose. But they should never have gone back. But that's how close we were. And we eventually got back into that hotel a few weeks later. And the windows were all strafed with bullet holes. And, you know, clearly there'd been quite a big battle there. But the other theatre of war is when the whole country is under siege, is under conflict. And that's what Syria is. Syria is probably the most dangerous, even more than Iraq, facing ISIS, who are the most vicious enemy I've come across. But even in Syria, as soon as you cross the border into Syria, and you were usually smuggled over the border, so you had to carry everything you needed. A flak jacket on, camera kit, carrying anything you were going to wear or need, you had to be hand carrying. But you would be taken by smugglers, traffickers, who you paid quite a lot of money towards. And, you know, you'd sort of be taken to the border, and eventually they'd have a system of people who are on the lookout for border patrols or whatever, and you'd be giving them none and you'd have to run for it.
And you saw your job as to report, let the world know what is going on in these awful zones.
Yeah, I mean, and it is pretty much, if you don't go, will anybody else go?
Are there many women? Are you one of a few?
There are a number. One of my friends calls us the old trouts club, because we're all of a certain age. Most of us aren't married and don't have any children, apart from Alex, who seems to be able to juggle both incredibly well. But yeah, I mean, there are a number of us. And, you know, in some respects, it's a positive for being a woman. And some respects, it's a negative. And, you know, same with men. I'd never ever allow anybody to say, well, you know, you're the weaker sex in that regard, because it's not true. But no, there are quite a few females. But on the question about, you know, you feel you need to go in, I sit there now, and at the moment I'm doing quite a bit of anchoring, so I sit in a very, you know, comfy, warm studio and talk to people who are out in the field. And I watch the sorts of coverage or the news that's coming out from some places like, at the moment, Yemen. She's very difficult to get into, and an incredibly heart-wrecking story unfolding that probably anybody's not covering enough. It's the worst humanitarian catastrophe in the whole world, and children are starving to death. And, you know, that's not good enough. Places like Eastern Ghouta and Damascus, they're starving to death. They're 45 minutes away from hospital and food, but they're under siege by Assad's forces. And the world sits back and does what? You know, Idlib, where I've been in northern Syria a lot, I have real fear the people that I've stayed with there so many times will be ethnically cleansed, because Assad wants now to wipe away anybody that stood against him.
Can you give an idiot's guide, if you will, simple, because it's so complicated, what is going on in Syria? Because most people, including me, just, I don't get it. I don't understand why he's allowed to continue in office.
Well, I mean, the basic story is it's a civil war against a regime that people stood up against after the rest of the Arab uprisings happened. And when I was going in early on in the conflict, people couldn't understand why the West has helped the Libyan rebels with their, you know, no-fly zone and their NATO airstrikes, which basically got rid of Gaddafi. They saw that as a sign that they could stand up and be counted and get rid of their dictator, and nobody came to their aid. And they used to ask me again and again, why will nobody come and help us? You know, we're getting killed here. Why don't they see we're just doing the same thing? And you say the word oil to them and they, you know, they just shrug their shoulders. That was the basic start of what happened in Syria. But it's become, after so many years, a proxy war for the neighbours and for the rest of the world.
So who are the goodies and who are the bad guys? Or is everybody a bit bad?
I would struggle to find the goodie, to be honest with you, because everybody wants it to shape it a certain way. I suppose you could say at least the West recognises if chemical weapons are used. They recognise that you can't now, or you shouldn't now, walk away and let Assad stay because of so much damage he's done to his people. So,
but why do the Russians and the Iranians want him in power?
Because they control him.
But what do they want or need his oil or what?
No, there is no oil in Syria. But no, Syria is an important part of that part of the world.
Of the geography.
Yeah, incredibly important part. And yeah, it's all about control. I mean, remember when Obama said, you know, if they cross the red line with the chemical weapons, and then they did. And he was wrong-footed by the Russians. I mean, Putin is playing a game there. Putin totally took the wind out of Obama's sails by going, well, you don't have to drop anything and kill people. You're a humanitarian person. Putin isn't. But, you know, the West doesn't want to kill people. I will sort out these dreadful chemical weapons. Now, here we are, however many years later since then, and they're still using chemical weapons in Syria. But Putin played a clever game. And in a way, I honestly believe Putin sees this as a game. But they also want power. For Putin, the Russians only have one harbour, one place that they can put battleships in the Mediterranean, and that is Syria. Mm. If he loses that, he's been looking at Egypt. He's talked to the Egyptians about maybe putting Russian warships in Alexandria. But at the moment, they still have control. Tartus, which is their harbour there in Syria, they want control to be able to put their warships there. For the Russians, that's about having some sort of strategic base in the Mediterranean. They think is incredibly important. And let's be honest, you know, the West, America, the UK, they all behave the same way. They all want to put their own strategic defences all over the world. And, you know, whether it's in Saudi Arabia or Qatar or in the Eastern European area, they want some sort of defence there. So Putin's just doing what the West has done. But for them, if they lose control of Syria, they lose that option.
You mentioned Egypt. You have a bit of a starried and scary association with Egypt. In fact, does the charge still stand against you? You were charged in absentia for terrorism.
Yeah, I mean, I'm effectively on the run when it comes to Egypt. They charged me. Yeah, I wasn't in the country at the time, but they arrested three of my colleagues and they charged seven Al Jazeera staff in all for terrorism offences. And they
was it true? Were they terrorists?
Yeah. Well, the background to all of this is. Qatar, Doha, who fund Al Jazeera, they basically were pushing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And of course, the Muslim Brotherhood won the first free presidential election after the revolution. Now, as we all know, the generals run Egypt. And even after Mubarak was unseated, the generals were still in charge. And they allowed this presidential election to happen. They weren't happy with who won it. But they never really allowed Morsi to take control of the country. They still, in a deep state, were running Egypt. And they wanted to shut up Al Jazeera because once there was a coup and they got rid of the Muslim Brotherhood president, Mohamed Morsi, they didn't want anybody to say anything negative about that. And the one channel that's watched more than any other channel in that part of the world is Al Jazeera Arabic, which is a sister channel to the one I was working for. And the only way they could shut them up was to put pressure on them. And they did that by picking up the journalists and locking them up.
Now, Peter
Grester,
he relieved you. I mean, that really could have been you. Isn't that true? The day before?
It wasn't the day before, but yeah, he was flown in to be a correspondent over Christmas and I was flown back to Doha to be the anchor for the Christmas period. So yeah, he was just doing holiday cover, really.
And you spearheaded the campaign to get...
Yeah, we all got convicted, but they were in the country. Yeah. So they happened to be sent to prison for between 7 and 10 years. And, you know, there was nothing else I could do. I'd been convicted for 10 years. And as I say, I am a convicted terrorist and still on the run with Egypt. But anybody that was in that situation would have gone, how the hell do we get them out? Mm. And so, yeah, we set up a campaign that we managed
Who's
to...
Who's we?
Myself and some of my brains... who can work out how to make something go viral, who can work out how do you set up a demonstration outside the Egyptian embassy without getting arrested, how can you get the diplomats to all line up and agree to try and, you know, push us forward.
And you had the very successful campaign, social media campaign.
We did the Ziplips,
The Ziplips.
Ziplips and the Free AJ staff. And yeah, it did go viral and, you know, people all over the world, journalists particularly, but also, you know, just ordinary people got on board, and it really captured the imagination. And you know, I don't think it was just because it was us. I think it was because they saw what
it was unjust. I mean there was no truth.
They saw this was an affront on the media. Yeah. And journalists quite often get a bad rap for all sorts of things, but people I do think value, especially in this day and age when you don't know what to trust as you're reading your Facebook page or your Twitter account or whatever, you don't know whether the person that's written it is somebody you should trust. I think more and more people are turning back to the traditional channels and wanting to trust that what they're hearing is true. So they recognise if a journalist is going to go into Egypt and it's going to be a very hard place to report from, which it was, you're risking your neck. And you're risking your freedom.
Well, journalists die. I mean, sometimes 60 a year.
No, a few of my colleagues have been killed. It is.
But you got them out, reminding people of the injustice of it. You did. They did get released after 400 days, I think.
Yes. I mean, I don't think it was just the media campaign. I think we helped, but there was a lot going on behind the scenes. I went to the State Department in the US on a number of occasions, had some very helpful meetings, and I was told that every time John Kerry went into a room with the Egyptians, the first thing he said was, "You need to release the Al Jazeera journalists."
Do you believe that?
I do believe that. I also believe on the day that we were convicted, he went bananas. He was in Cairo. He made a speech the day before saying he believed Egypt was on the right path, roadmap to democracy, as they called it. And he went, when he heard that we'd been convicted, he was screaming in the embassy that he wanted to speak to the president immediately. And I, you know, I totally believe that. I don't have, my sources is about as high as you could get, to be honest.
Do you think that your conviction, in inverted commas, quote marks, impacted your ability to work after that?
No, completely. You know, it wasn't long after that that the boss said to me, "I want to send you to Yemen." And we worked out I couldn't go, because to go to Yemen at the time, you had to go via Djibouti. And the conviction doesn't just stop me going to Egypt. It stops me going to a lot of countries who would be sympathetic to handing me over to Egypt. And
like
the problem
what?
With, like most of Africa, the African Union have agreements. If you are a convicted terrorist, you will be handed over to the other African country if you go through their country. Like Russia, very, as I said, mentioned before, you know, Alexandria was a possible place for Russians to put their battleships. And, you know, the Russians and the Egyptians are very close now. Like the UAE, flying through Dubai can be an issue. If I stay on the airport, it should be okay. But they're very close to Egypt now as well. So just have to...
Are you scared?
It gets a little nerve-wracking when you go through immigration and you're not 100%. I was in South Africa not long after because we thought South Africans should be all right. But funnily enough, while I was there, I switched on the TV and there was Jacob Zuma and Sisi having a cup of tea together. And, you know, as a journalist, it's not like you're going on holiday and you're just under the wire. If you're going and you're reporting, you're probably live on air for that country, and it just needs their president to flick on the TV and go, you know, "Oh, hang on a minute, isn't she wanted?" That it becomes an issue. So, yeah, going through the airports can be a little bit nerve-wracking.
And like, you work mostly at this time for Al Jazeera. Again, you stopped working for them a bit because you weren't able to travel as freely as you needed to as a war correspondent. And now you're back doing a lot of work for them, a lot of anchoring, as in newscasting and news reading, which you've done with Channel 4 before. You've done that a lot. Do you think that in the West we give Al Jazeera the credit for impartiality, or are they partial?
I think what was clear before Al Jazeera America set up, which in my mind was a mistake, because there was such a growing viewership online for Al Jazeera English in America. It was very strong, especially a younger generation who were thirsty to know what the hell was going on in the rest of the world and didn't really buy into a lot of the American network coverage, especially the amount of showbiz stuff that's done and stuff that's not really recognised as being important. And I think we were getting very good traction. And unfortunately, the firewall came down because Al Jazeera America was wanting to be given a good shout. And Al Jazeera America didn't work out. I do think the younger generation see it more. I think they don't find it threatening. They don't.
But is it impartial? I mean, I think it is. I've watched it.
Yeah.
I think they get an unfair
rap. If you're used to a Western appetite of Western networks, then you'll be like, "What is this?" Because it will just feel different. Mm. And because if we do a story about what's going in Israel and Palestine, you'll have people on it that you know are talking about what the hell happened in their lives when the Israeli soldiers came into through their front door, and you'll see a completely different perspective. Also, I think Is it impartial? No news is ever impartial. It's not the way the journalist speaks. You know, we all try and speak as fairly and compassionately on either side as we can. It's the decision as to where you put your resources is never going to be impartial. So if you send, you know, like in Libya, we covered the revolution. We had six teams on the ground during the Libyan revolution. Most channels probably had two at the most, maybe three, but usually two. We had six. Now, I think a good five of them were on the rebel side and one of them was on the Gaddafi side. That wasn't because we were trying to give more scope to what was going on the rebel side. It's just because the Gaddafi side would only let in one team. So immediately you've got more coverage on one side. So it can't be impartial. Why do you send your team somewhere? And maybe why do you start the bulletin with a story about how Eastern Ghouta in Damascus in Syria has just been hit by a chemical attack? Why do you do that? Well, because you go, "We think that's important." Well, that's not impartial, though, is it? Well, no, but Assad won't let a team into his side. So immediately you're not impartial. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I do.
And every network goes through this decision as to where to put their resources. It's impossible not to. But then I'm going to Afghanistan in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to be with the top US general there. And I'm going to try and do a documentary about how he sees what's going on in Afghanistan, what he thinks should be happening, whether he thinks it's right to talk to the Taliban. Now, I could do another documentary in another few months' time with the Taliban. That's right. One side or the other. But, you know,
that doesn't mean, yeah, you're just showing both sides of the argument. Now, I'd like to talk to you about, we are friends. I've known you for years and it's never come up in our conversation. But the issue of sexual harassment, have you ever been a victim of it in news? Is it a problem in news, do you think?
You know what, when the Me Too campaign came up,
yeah.
I think we all talked about, is there anybody that hasn't? Because I think our era, when we were coming through, and, you know, nowadays, you know, they wouldn't bloody dare. But when right. we were coming through and we didn't have the strength or the confidence to say that's outrageous. Yeah, it was happening all over the place.
Well, sexual. I mean, I've come across bullies running newsroom men. But never sexual harassment, I would say.
No, I remember working for one programme when I was in my 20s, and there was a very famous presenter who used to come into the office, and any of the young women would either dive under the table or suddenly nip to the loo, because he would come in, and he eventually got sacked for all sorts of bad sexual behaviour, to be honest. But he used to come in and he would give you his morning welcome, and that was, you know, a hug that was way too invasive. Right. That sort of stuff would happen.
I can't imagine
time.
Anyone doing that to you and getting away with it.
So. Well, not now. But, you know, one of the things before I got convicted of terrorism that I was being, will be always remembered was having my bum pinched live.
That's
on air.
Right.
Now, let's just go through that a little bit. So there I am covering the floods for Channel 4 News in the UK in Oxford. And this guy out of nowhere just came up behind me, grabbed my bum and walked off. That was live. And the newspapers did a whole, every single newspaper covered it.
It was
on the front page
of
the Daily Mail, the full pages in the Sun, and even the Qualities, the Times and the Telegraph and whatever. They all did stories on it. And at that time, if you think back then, everybody thought it was funny. Mm. And even my friends thought it was funny. And it was hugely embarrassing for me, but I had to sort of take it on the chin, literally, and go, well, you know, okay. The local constabulary, the local police chief constable got in touch, who was a woman, and said, do you want to press charges for sexual harassment? And I went, no, you know. But the press were so keen to do an interview, they eventually put out a statement saying, look, you know, I see the funny side. But I have to say that, you know, any woman in a bar that suddenly finds somebody just grabbing her on her bum, that's not acceptable. She didn't ask for it. That's just not acceptable. And of course, the day after the press did this whole thing about, oh, I just soldiered on and blah, blah, then there was a backlash and they then ripped me apart. And the Sun columnist, Kelvin McKenzie, said, you know, who does she think she is saying, you know, it's not acceptable, and really was quite vicious. Now, I would hope that nowadays, after what we've just been through and with this cultural shift, even that wouldn't be acceptable, to rip somebody apart for saying, no, you don't touch me. You don't touch me anywhere, but especially not on my bum. And especially when I am completely oblivious to somebody behind me and the world is kind of watching me on the news.
Yeah.
It's not. But there has been a shift. Definitely a shift.
And you're happy to see it.
Gosh, yeah.
And what about the inequality of pay? Kerry Gracie, another outstanding journalist. I've watched her reports on the BBC and I'm just blown away. First of all, by the standard of her journalism, but the way she speaks fluent Chinese. I mean, I think she's wonderful. She's always been one of my favourites. And then we hear that she's resigned as an editor because she found out she was paid half, 50% of what her male colleagues were paid. What's your take on
that? Yeah, well, you know, I worked for Channel 4 for 12 years, and I never forget when I don't know what brought it about, but we had an episode where everybody put on a sort of page on the office computer, not who they were, but then their job description and their salary and their sex. And we found out that the most senior in the foreign department, the most senior woman who was the foreign editor, but on the ground, so, you know, top foreign, senior foreign correspondent
on screen. She was the top of the department, and there was somebody who was just a straightforward foreign correspondent who was earning more than her, and he was a man. You know, as we all looked at this and went, but that's crazy. How can that be? And they had no answer to it. They had no answer. And how else?
She didn't resign then?
No, she didn't resign. I think she did manage to get a pay rise, but this is a while ago. But there was no sense of, oh no, you've highlighted something. It was just like, oh no, they found something out.
Right.
And it is interesting when you look at the way the BBC's reacted to Kerry's sort of argument. And the reason she left, you know, was because she highlighted it and they didn't do anything about it.
Well, they did offer her a pay rise, but still not parity.
Still not as much, yeah. Mm. And now the guys have said, we'll take a pay cut, which, to be honest with you, they had to, because, you know, it's the British Broadcasting Corporation. You can't suddenly just give somebody a load more money.
I don't think they should have taken a pay cut, but she should have been on the
well,
same.
Well, we all do, because we all think they're paid too much as it is, but that's because they earn a lot more than we do. But yeah, I mean, you know, the one thing I would say about Al Jazeera is it kind of isn't really set up on those lines.
Mm. Everybody gets paid a load of money.
Well, you know, if you are based in Doha, you get paid tax-free. If you're based in London, sadly, that's not the case.
Was that you were paid tax-free for a long time? Very pleasing?
Yes, very pleasing. Thank you very much.
Keep calm and chat on.
I want to talk about your book. Because you were inspired, I think, after the campaign, which absolutely played a part in getting your colleagues freed. You've written a young adult book called This Book Will Help You Change the World.
Yeah, just a sort of humble title.
It's very humble. What you're encouraging people to do, young people, protest injustice, campaign for change, and vote for your future. I've read it, by the way. I bought it to support my friend and was very pleasantly surprised how much I enjoyed it, because it's really important. It's timely. What age group are you aiming for?
It's teenagers and early 20s.
Yeah.
But do you know what? I went on BBC Breakfast to promote it with an old colleague of mine who used to be producer at Channel 4, who now is one of their rising stars and presenter. And just before we went on air, she went, oh my God, I read it, so I learned so much.
Yeah,
I was like, what? It's not wasn't aimed at you. She said, no. And one of my other colleagues who works for The Times said, it's the same thing. Every journalist should read it, definitely. Because what it does do, it kind of...
It simplifies.
Yeah,
and it explains
it does.
How the system works.
It explains how the system works and how it doesn't work. And it explains, hopefully the second half is like a toolkit, that if you have something you want to shout about... the best way to go about it. And the other thing I tried to tackle, because this is something that I find is close to my heart, I went to a very basic state school. And I realised, especially when I got to Channel 4, which was very kind of Oxbridge, you know, very much highbrow university people when I went there, and I think they saw me as this kind of tabloid oik that came in, that I was never taught at school how to debate. I was never taught how to public speak. I was never taught... or given confidence that what my opinion mattered. Whereas I think that kids get sent to, you know, posher schools, or maybe they just learn it from home, but definitely at school, they have that sense more. So what it also does, it tries to get you to, if you have to give a speech about something that you feel strongly about, or you have to tackle somebody, even if it's debating online, some of the key basic things to think about before you do that. So hopefully, as I say, the toolkit, but giving you lots of different tools, not just to say, how do I set up a march? How do I launch a petition? You know, if I want to try and even run for Parliament, what are the things you need to do about that, to go about it?
Yes. And let's talk a little bit about the current President of the United States. how do you feel he's perceived around the world?
Well... that's a big question. I think he's perceived...
Is he respected and admired and looked up to?
I can't say I've ever heard those words in the same sentence as his name. I suppose, at best, they think he will shut down the borders and the entrance... areas of access to America and do his best for the American economy. I think at worst, people think that the image that he portrays, which is disrespectful to women.
He's a bully.
He is a bully. Disrespectful pretty much to anybody that isn't from his own class and colour. not just is damaging for the image of America, but also it almost gives the freedom to other badly behaved leaders to carry on doing what they already do. You know, the whole idea that you call the press fake news when you don't like what they say about you, it's kind of developing world dictatorship behavior. Yeah. It's not what you expect from the leader of the free world. And when you have somebody like President Sisi, who, you know, locked up three journalists for doing nothing other than just trying to tell the story.
Yeah.
He has become quite pally with President Trump.
Okay.
Spot the difference, I think I tweeted at one point. I worry in that regard that it is trickling down, that kind of accepted behaviour.
So do you worry for humanity? You've seen so much bad, evil, cruelty and suffering with your work, but have you seen as much good on that we don't know about?
Well, just on that sort of the seeing things around the world, you know, the one thing, Obama didn't always get things right, but you did trust that if something truly bad was going on, that his heart was in the right place. Mm. And the biggest fear I have for humanity now is, like northwestern Syria, where I have people who I call my friends and they even call me their family, I honestly fear they will be ethnically cleansed because Assad is just being allowed to do what the hell he wants to do. And that kind of, you know, I never believed in America being the world policeman, especially when I was in Afghanistan. Many ways, but there has to be a power in the world that worries about what is going on behind closed doors to people and behind closed countries to people. And that was the one thing that you kind of thought that's what America stood for, and I worry that's not the case anymore. As for whether there is goodness in the world, you know, I mean, people say, why do you cover conflict? Why would you put yourself in that position? And one of the overriding reasons is because you see the absolute reality of the way people are. You see the very, very best and the very, very worst. You know, when their backs are against the wall and they think they or their children or their families or their communities are about to be wiped out, you will see extraordinary behavior to try and protect people, to help people. People put themselves at risk. People give their lives to try and save other people, like you wouldn't believe. And then you also see the very, very worst. You know, you'll see death. You'll see children killed. You'll see.
Have you witnessed children killed?
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, I mean, in the end, yeah, I've got this phrase, you don't just put your body armor on, you put your mental armor on. And the only time I think it really sort of hits home is when you don't have that mental armor on. And that is when, yeah, there's been a couple of occasions when we've been almost sleeping rough in Syria, or at least sleeping bundled up on somebody's floor next to a little fire to try and keep warm, when we've been reporting right at the front line and whatever. And something will happen when you're half asleep and you won't be protecting yourself. It'll just come to you. We had one point where we were with the doctor in Idlib when this little baby was brought in, quite a new baby, and it stopped breathing, and it should have been rushed to hospital, but it was just too much shelling going on. And the doctor's equipment was way too big. You know, he had no children's equipment, so he had no mask that fitted the baby's mouth. It was bigger than the baby's head, and the sort of instrument that goes down into the throat area was way too big. And it was 4 a.m, we'd been fast asleep, and he was basically by the fire right in front of us trying to resuscitate this baby, and he couldn't. And we filmed it. I mean, the cameraman looked at me as if to say, please don't make me, but I said, you have to. And the baby died right in front of us. Now, if that had happened while we'd been out in the field that day, you'd have just sort of taken it on the chin and carried on. But it happened while we were half asleep, you know, within our little kind of bosom of protection. And I think that really affected all of us. And even though we were shot at and shelled later that afternoon because we ended up in a battle for the airport, the one thing we couldn't quite get past that day was that.
Wow, it's just heartbreaking, heartbreaking. Now, you mentioned children suffering, and you mentioned in the beginning, and you laughed it off about the fact you haven't got children and that many female war correspondents don't have children. Do you feel that's a price that you've paid for being a career girl in this field where you can be sent anywhere at the drop of a hat?
Yeah, I don't think it's just the fact you could get sent anywhere, because a lot of people have professions where they, you know, they...
They're not in war zones for months at a time.
No, no, that's true. But, I mean, you can still do the job not to have to go away for such long periods of time, or, you know, you have sort of another half. I think some people make decisions that they don't want to put themselves in those situations if they've got children that they're at home. I think also it does harden you up. And then when I was doing the 6 years when I was doing nothing but going in and out of war zones, you know, there is no space for anything other than preparing yourself for a mission and getting back from it. And, you know, sort of you kind of come back and you kind of let the steam out for a few days, usually drink too much, which is the way a journalist, you know, comes back down from the heights of that.
Yeah, it is an issue. For some journalists,
they call it decompressing in Afghanistan. When you're based in Afghanistan, you don't stay there totally for months and months. You do come out for a week every so many weeks, because you have to decompress, because you don't realize it, but actually your shoulders around your ears for the whole time you're there. And it's not till you get back and you kind of, you know, sort of sit somewhere that is completely safe, then you feel that. Remember, I used to come out and I couldn't listen to fireworks. It was just too similar. And even hearing a jet overhead, I'd be sort of heading for a doorway before I realised where I was. Because when you're in somewhere like Syria, if you hear a jet, it generally means you're about to be bombed, or at least you're in danger of being. So you immediately go somewhere that you think will give you some sort of protection. So, you know, you are in that kind of whirlwind in your brain. And so, I think... That's difficult and must be very difficult if you do have children. A lot of soldiers talk about coming back to the banality of life and, I don't know, turning up at a barbecue and people complaining about the weather and just wanting to kill them all because they're like, don't you realise people are dying? You know, but I think the fact that I came to doing war and conflict later on in my career is helpful.
And of course, soldiers, female soldiers, have pay the same price and have the same anxieties. It's extraordinary. I'd like to thank you for the sacrifices you've made in telling us the truth.
Thank you, Claire.
Give us a hug. Bless you, darling.
Oh, bless you.
Great interview.
We simply must applaud them, the chat podcast with Claire Fordham.
People don't come more interesting or inspiring than Sue Turton. Thanks, Sue. On the next episode of The Chat with Claire Fordham, I'll be interviewing Nick Gatfield, the former Dexys Midnight Runner, who went on to run music behemoths Universal, EMI and Sony. Nick signed Amy Winehouse and Radiohead, among many other top acts. Nick talks about Amy's genius and her battle with alcohol, today's music industry, and what it was like being a Dexys Midnight Runner. Nick Gatfield is super smart and very funny. Of course he is. How else would he get on The Chat? Until next time, thanks for listening, keep calm, and chat on.
We simply must applaud them, the chat podcast with Claire Fordham. Keep calm and chat on.
The Chat with Claire Fordham is an M Squared production.